75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they?
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Larry Bryant, it's a pleasure talking to you. And this book, UFO Politics in the White House, is a fast and a good read. And the interesting thing about it is your qualifications. I think you're qualified to write this book.
You know, Jerry, in a couple of weeks I'll be 67 years old, and I have spent at least 40 years of that time chasing the UFO subject, trying to find out what does the government know and when did it know it about UFO reality. And my experience in the field dates back to the old NICAP days, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, headed up by that retired Marine Corps major who's now, of course, a legend in the field himself, Donald Kehoe.
Did you ever have a chance to meet Kehoe?
Absolutely did, more than once. He used to send me Christmas cards from his little house down in Luray, Virginia. I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and he used to live here as well. I'm a native Virginian, and of course Kehoe isn't, but he spent a lot of time, he spent his last...
Well, Alexandria is right in the heart of the Washington, D.C. area.
At the seat of government, you might say. I live 3 miles from the Pentagon. I used to work in the Pentagon. I was able to walk home once in a while when I wanted to clear my mind a little bit. And experience is a good teacher, of course. It's also a tool for writers who want to record their thoughts, ideas, achievements, and activism in paper and other media, so that the public can benefit from all this experience.
You know, when we talk about this book, you've certainly got a lot of things in there. Why don't you... Now, did you ever work in the White House itself?
Of course, the White House is another institution right across the river from the Pentagon. And I was captivated by Jimmy Carter's promise back when he was running for office as to be our new president. He somehow, because of his own UFO sighting when he was governor of Georgia, capitulated into the public scene on the UFO question. People would write to him and say, listen, you, Jimmy Carter, are something of an expert at this point because you and a group of other people down in Georgia did see something that you couldn't identify, and therefore we want you to help us, the reading public, get to the bottom of the UFO mystery, to find out what the government really does know about this subject and open up the files. So something possessed Jimmy Carter to make a promise that if he did get elected, he would indeed try to open up as much as he could about the subject and official government files.
You know, yeah, I don't have any inside knowledge, of course, but... always had the impression that he was sincere when he made that promise.
You know, this is Mr. Sincerity you're talking about here.
Yes.
He comes off as a true American icon of sincerity, honesty, to the public interest.
I think there's no doubt about that, and he's really proven himself as an ex-president as well.
And as a writer and thinker in his own right, he came along at the right time, but he dropped the ball. And this book is a history of that missed opportunity.
Yeah, why do you think he dropped the ball?
Thousands of letters from citizens did end up at the White House mailroom, on the order of at least 9,000, according to one account, but they ended up being disposed of out of hand. They either got thrown away, filed away, ignored, or otherwise short shrifted by the White House staff. And this is a travesty because we now know in hindsight that if we had our hands on some of that, all of that material, we'd have a far better picture of what was going on during the Carter years about UFO secrecy, UFO information access policies and practices of the government.
Where were you during the Carter years?
I was working at the Pentagon as a writer and editor in public affairs work, technical writing as well. I date back my federal service career dates back to when I was 20 years old and started working at a little army post in Virginia and worked my way up through the system and retired in 1994. And here I am, still knocking on the UFO door.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the kind of reactions you get when you knock on that UFO door here in a moment. I'd like to follow up a little bit more about the letters in the book. How did you come by those? Freedom of Information Act or what?
Right. I started using the U.S. Freedom of Information Act as a tool to get to the hidden evidence of UFO reality. So I was an early plier of the FOIA trade, you might say, the bright idea occurred to me somehow back in the late 70s to say, listen, I myself have written to Jimmy Carter about this subject. I wanted him to comply with his own promise to the public. And I wrote him a letter, and I said, well, if I'm writing a letter to him, I have a feeling that other people are, too. So I said, okay, I want to see what these people are writing, and so I fired off a Freedom of Information request to the Air Force. And the rest, as they say, is history. I'd like it to be repeated for other presidents, but that's not easily done these days, given the climate of secrecy in all our institutions.
And I understand during the Clinton administration there were some efforts to find out about UFOs.
Yeah, efforts are well documented by a website run by a Canadian researcher, Grant Cameron.
Yeah, Grant we've had on the air with us many times.
Your listeners in America and elsewhere can easily access presidential .com. Not too sure of the URL at this point, but it's in the book, and you can Google it up and find out what the whole Clinton White House take was on UFO reality.
Now, we're going to get into the secrecy aspect of it that's going on today here in a moment. Before I do that, I'd be remiss if I couldn't talk to you a little bit about the quality of the letters to President Carter that you uncovered for your book. Were they basically just questions, or were people writing about their experiences, or was the whole gamut covered?
Well, you know, Jerry, the beauty of the book is you can open that in any portion of the book, depending on your mood of the day, you can get a flavor of just about everything you can imagine, from religious committed people who want to remind Jimmy Carter of his own faith, mm-hmm. oriented approach to life. There are a number of religious angles to read about in this book, and then you have people like lawyers who have written to the president, engineers, retired, former military personnel. One of my favorite letters is from a Navy officer, a young Navy officer who was somehow committed to knowing more about the subject and offered his services as a Navy person, you know, Jimmy Carter,
a Navy
graduate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of my favorite letters in the book. Another one, of course, comes from a psychologist who wrote what I view as the best letter in the book, in which he outlined a proposal to the White House for a commission to be instituted under presidential guidance to come up with a better picture of what UFOs mean to society and vice versa.
You know, there's a movement now in Washington with Stephen Bassett and a few other people, Dr. Stephen Greer, trying to get, more information from the government to come clean. I don't know if that's going to be successful at all. However, there are some programs now dealing with UFOs, and of course this Peter Jennings special coming up. You wonder though a lot of times whether this is real information or disinformation, and I guess time will tell.
Yeah, whenever you have a mystery, you have the chance for bad information, good information, misinformation that's funneled out there for whatever purpose by the, whatever person's desiring to do such a thing. It's all thrown into the mix, and that's what makes us feel this Antarctic field of UFO research a compelling one for me. You know, how do you sustain an interest in this field for more than 40 years? Well, it's pretty easy. You start reading the literature and start tracking what other researchers are doing and plan to do, like Stephen Bassett with his disclosure efforts. Stephen is, in my view, a genius in gathering together a perspective of the political importance of this subject.
Yeah, I've known Stephen for a long time, and even back when he ran for Congress here in Maryland.
I helped Steve do a monumental effort in putting door hangers on doorknobs all through his congressional district during that period, and I got to know that man as almost as well as a brother, and I endorse his efforts. Sometimes he can get distracted like anybody else because it's such an amorphous field. You have to stay focused, and Steve has the mindset to do this
now,
work.
When we talk about you have Pentagon experience, and then we talk about these black projects and secret movements and the CIA, which I'll get into here in a moment with you and get some ideas from you. But first of all, I want to go all the way back to Major Keyhoe. There's all kinds of stories about Project Blue Book on whether or not that was for real, or whether or not it was in its own self some sort of government cover-up. What's your take on Major Keyhoe and NICAP and the whole thing?
Well, Major Keyhoe, as I say, it's a legend. And he was a professional writer long before he caught on to the UFO subject, which he had started when he was writing articles and short stories for the existing magazines of his era. He of course had, because he was a Marine Corps pilot, he had ended up being disabled during the service, but he kept his contacts alive in the military. And they would confide in him every time they would get their hands on reliable UFO reports. And this was a distraction to the government because the government prefers to be in control of everything it touches. And so they viewed Keyhoe as a threat to that control, rightly or wrongly. And of course, he did not view himself as a threat to anything except baseless government secrecy on this subject. He didn't think the government should have it both ways in saying that there's nothing to it. Meantime, we're committing tax dollars to investigating behind the scenes how serious this subject is. This was a form of hypocrisy that Keyhoe could not stomach, and therefore he became a specialist in this field and wrote several books about it.
Now, when you were at the Pentagon, Did you, and you were interested in UFOs during that time even, did you ever broach that subject to someone inside the Pentagon?
My close friends in my work area, they were fully aware of what I was doing. In fact, if you go back to the mid-80s, I ended up getting a little more visibility than I needed on the subject because I had filed a petition in U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. It was called a petition for writ of habeas corpus extraterrestrial.
Uh-huh.
The judge of that court bring forth the retained bodies, if you will. Habeas corpus is a Latin phrase, meaning you will have the body.
Right,
used in criminal defense cases in which, you know, the defendant says, hey, prove that you have a reason for incarcerating me. And so a hearing is held, and the two sides appear and decide whether or not there's ample legitimate evidence for a defendant's detention. Well, my theory of the petition was that either a dead or a live alien retrieved from the Roswell crash in 1947 has a habeas corpus right to be brought before the court. And so it was a novel idea, but it certainly caught on with major publicity all over the place. And as a result of that particular case, which, by the way, was dismissed on technical grounds, but the court treated it just as seriously as any other case it would get. I'm not a lawyer, by the way, but I know plenty of people who are, and I try to pick their brains whenever I can to make the law work on this subject as best as I can. Now listen, because of that publicity about the habeas corpus lawsuit, I got the idea of saying, okay, well, there's other ways to skin this UFO cat. And I'm going to start knocking on the military's door. And I did that by submitting various classified advertisements to military newspapers.
That's a good idea. So you're in the Army Times, Air Force Times, things like that.
Those are private military.
Well, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Literally inside the
big Navy and Air Force bases that are printed by a commercial printer, but they're owned by the government. And so I started submitting these ads mainly to the newspaper that serves personnel at the Pentagon. It's called The Pentagram. And I was seeking whistleblower evidence from UFO cover-up witnesses. Anything that they might want to share with the public would be welcomed by me. And while I never did get any great fish out of this trolling exercise, I did make some contacts with people who otherwise would not have shown an interest in the subject. And a few of these people work right there in the headquarters.
Did, when you put those ads in there, did somebody show up and say, hey,
yeah,
what are you doing?
One person did, but not in an official. This was an intelligence employee who has a personal interest in the subject. And he didn't call me up. He came to my house. And so we've, since that time, had a an enduring relationship on the subject matter. He even put out a newsletter at one point called the Phoenix Newsletter. But there's one other development from this whole campaign, and that is not every paper wanted to print the ads that I would submit. One or two of them, mostly Air Force, said that they weren't going to do it. I said, what? You're not going to print an ad that I've freely given you the money to print, and needless to say, this became a red flag, or what do you do when a red flag is posted in front of a bull? You watch the bull charge at it, and so the red flag went up, and I want to charge it. So if you want to take a break here, I can continue the story.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to, you know, very, very interesting. Yeah, we'll be right back. We're talking with Larry Bryant.
I should write a whole book about this, and I probably will someday.
Larry Bryant worked at the Pentagon for many, many, many years. He has a book out called UFO Politics in the White House. And Larry, when we went to the break, you were telling the story about you placing ads in military newspapers, particularly the one in the Pentagon itself, a classified ad wanting to have people come forward with UFO evidence. From what I remember before the break, some people turned you down, flat down.
There were a few cases where I got flat turned downs. These newspapers really are newspapers.
Yeah, uh-huh.
They carry news of and features about military programs and policies and family issues and pay matters. All the good stuff that soldiers, airmen, Marines want to know in the course of their daily work. But in order to pay for the production of these papers, the government contracts the printing and distribution out to local commercial printers. They are the ones charged with gathering the ads and keeping the revenue to offset the printing costs. And unfortunately, some of these public affairs officers which monitor and actually serve as the true publisher of the newspapers, feel that they have a right and a duty to censor advertising copy. Well, this is not exactly their duty. They have a right to review ads to make sure that they don't break the law. They don't want your classified information to show up in the ads. But beyond that little bit of managerial, they have no right to either accept or reject an ad. That function revolves on around the printer. In any case, the public affairs officers who made this offensive move to stymie the publication of my ads raised the red flag. I charged by filing a First Amendment lawsuit in federal district court in the Eastern District of Virginia, right here in Alexandria, saying that this action on the part of the government is illegal. It violates my First Amendment right of speech and freedom of the press. You know, freedom of the press is guaranteed not just to somebody who owns a press. And in any case, I filed that complaint in federal court. Didn't take long for the government to say, hey, okay, you're right, let's have a settlement. And lo and behold, it didn't take too long, a few months later or less, settled that particular issue with what's known as a consent order from the court, in which the government agreed not to let public affairs officers at all these military installations interfere with my ad submission. So since that time, I've been able to place, and mainly in the Pentagon, the Pentagon's newspaper, various ads still about UFO incidents, UFO cover-up suspected or actual, just trying to get a deep throat or two to come forward and say, hey, enough of this unwarranted UFO secrecy. I want to help break that bubble and spill the beans. I'm ready to sign a deathbed confession or whatever they want to say. So there you go.
Are you having any luck with that?
Oh, not particularly, except there is one person, let's call him John Doe, who was a security worker, a security guard, actually, at an embassy in Australia, our U.S. embassy, back in, I think it was in the 70s. John Doe was on duty late one night, and he was called upon to serve as a courier of some important message traffic, telegrams that had been sent from higher headquarters in the military, and copies furnished by way of the Canberra, Australia satellite tracking station. Apparently some objects had been seen by radar or other tracking media as interfering with some of our military super secret satellites orbiting the Earth. Back then, that was a major concern of, I mean, can you imagine being an engineer with the military and looking at the data and saying, wait a minute, there's something deliberately interfering with our satellite transmission. And so this got their hackles up. And he actually read this very sensitive information, but that, of course, he's not allowed to make copies of that. He made a mental note of it, and he's contacted me about it, but since that contact, I still haven't been able to track down any records pertaining to that event. If it did occur, we're talking about the smoking gun, and it should be resurrected for the history of this subject, especially since it's been 30 years or so since that event. And why is the government sitting on it? Who knows? And I've actually submitted an ad to the Pentagram, and it's been published about that particular case. But I'm still waiting for Deep Throat to step forward.
What's the best way to contact you in case someone? What do you put on these ads? How do they get a hold of you?
I put my sometimes I put my whole address, phone number, my.
Yeah, well, let's do that. We also have it posted on the website, since you don't mind.
I live in, as I say, in Virginia, and it's area code 703-931-3341. My internet email address is overtci, that's O-V-E-R-T-C-I, at cavtel.net.
And we also have the email address on our website, so where this interview will be posted to run 24/7. You know, when you do these things and you have basically, they can't say you're a mole. You're out there in public advertising, saying I want to know more information.
They know that I mean business at this point. They can pick up a copy of my book. That just got published by Galdi Press in a new edition, and they can hold it up and say, listen, this guy means business. He not only dispatches freedom of information requests to every agency he can think of, he does something with the material once he gets his hands on it. And I hope will serve as a model for young people to come forward and join the crowd, because you're not going to make any headway unless you keep knocking on the inner sanctum's door. We're talking about the UFO inner sanctum, the group of people that might number no more than 300 or 400 with the hard evidence that we're seeking. Hard evidence that supposedly doesn't exist. And if it does exist, it's not classified according to Uncle Sam's a pronouncement. But do we want to believe Uncle Sam on this subject? No, of course not, because you can look back at all that CIA and NSA, DIA, UFO-related literature, and realize that the public got hoodwinked back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s on this subject. We now know the jig is up, and it's time to take the proper action and cultivate more UFO research from young people and others, professional people, to get to the bottom of the issue.
When we're going to take a break when we come back, were you in the Washington, D.C. area in 1952?
No, but I was in Virginia in that time, and I was well aware of
Let's talk about that when we come back, and talk a little bit more about your book, and we haven't really gotten into the secret part of this, and I want to talk a little bit about that. This is Jerry Pippin. You're listening to the UFO File. Well, you've heard us talk about 2012. It looks like December 21st, 2012, could be the end of everything. You want to read about it? You can, simply by clicking on the little pyramid on the left side of our website at jerrypippin.com, the one with the eye and the one near the atomic explosion. And you'll go over to Joe Isaac and his page. We have an interview with Joe. He is a man of prophecy. And he's written a book called A Remnant. I implore you to go over there and investigate it. Just click on the little pyramid with the eye, and you'll be there. And take a few minutes to listen to the interview and look over The Remnant. It's prophecy that may be true. We'll leave it up to you. Let you make your own mind up. Joe Isaac is quite a prophecy expert. And it's quite a book, The Remnant. Larry Bryant is our guest on the phone from Alexandria, Virginia. And you had to be, I was in junior high, I guess, when all of a sudden pictures of flying saucers over the Capitol were in the paper. Remember that?
Absolutely. That's a milestone case in the history of UFO research.
I've never figured out how we let it go away.
Well, you know, it was a case of what I call another missed opportunity in this field. This field is rife with the missed opportunities for whatever reason. The reading public is fickle. It's also beset with a short memory span, attention span. And when you have this combination manipulated by insider government interest, then you have exactly what we have today, that who knows if we'll ever get off the treadmill of government manipulation, what they call news management back in early administrations. We're talking about UFO news management.
We're talking about news management and a lot of things, and even a little worse than that these days, in my opinion, but that's another subject.
My first published article about UFO research was called A Hard Look at UFO News Management in the February 1964 issue of Faith magazine. And what I wrote in that little piece, it holds true today. We have a failure of the body politic to do its homework on this subject, especially the organized mainstream news media. They don't want to touch the subject. They're afraid of it. And why? Because the news media today are corporately owned operations. And a corporate entity does not want to rock the boat when it comes to government policy and procedures and government influence. It can't afford to do that. So the real research is not being done by investigative reporters at the Washington Post, for example. It's being done by loners and independent researchers operating on shoestring budgets, labor of love, as you would say. And that's the tragedy of this subject that dates back even beyond 1952. There was some media coverage, certainly, of the subject, but they didn't go deep enough. They should have put out, these reporters back then should have put ads in the Washington Post saying, listen, we're on to something here. Help us find some more information. Blow the whistle. Come forward. Slip us some hardcore evidence that the 1952 flyovers at the Capitol area meant something more than what the superficial treatment was being done by the existing media in those days. Radar contact may or may not have been a legitimate confirmation of any visual sighting, but the fact that it was recorded by FAA people, it stands on the record, and it shows that multiple sightings, multiple witness sightings, coupled with radar contact, represent solid evidence that shouldn't be ignored by anybody. You don't have too many cases like this, and that was one of the first ones on record. And who knows how many's going on today, for example, with all these Navy ships at sea, which has a wide view of the horizon with their radar systems, and people who get out on the deck of the carrier and look for themselves. We're talking a magnificent opportunity for the government to learn more about the UFO presence. Matter of fact, I think the Navy is the one behind the cover-up. I can't prove it, but from my readings, I would infer that the Navy has the best resources, the best secrecy cover than anybody else to collect, analyze, and sit on hardcore data on UFO reality.
Well, Navy intelligence got involved in this early on, no doubt about it.
Absolutely. They were involved in that top secret estimate of the situation that the Air Force Intelligence Center out in Wright Patterson Air Force Base came up with in 1948. You know, when I write my memoirs on this, one little anecdote will involve a visit to my office at Fort Eustis when I was a young clerk serving in federal service. I in effect got in trouble with the Navy intelligence people.
Larry, you answered a question I was going to ask. You started out at Fort Eustis, huh?
Actually, I started at Fort Monroe as a clerk typist in 1958, and a few years later I moved on to Fort Eustis as a clerk, and never gave up my interest in this subject.
Now, the Navy visited you while you were a clerk at Fort Eustis. Why?
That's correct. I, in my secondary research, I fired off, I think it was a postcard to the Director of Naval Intelligence at the Pentagon, and asked him for a copy of a Navy regulation on reporting UFOs. Now, how did I find out about that regulation? It was printed in as an appendix to one of Kehoe's books. So, turns out that they viewed that as not, either they didn't know that, or they didn't want me to know it. In any case, they sent a special investigator to interview me as to why I was interested in that instruction.
Hmm.
And, I explained it, you know, overt Larry here, sir. I explained that right flat out to the man who investigated me. Here's what happened after that. I didn't get fired, but I viewed this as a form of intimidation. Why? Because he didn't come to my home to interview me as a private citizen. He came to my office as if to say, hey, we're keeping an eye on you, Mr. Bryant. You know, be careful what you write as a private citizen, because we might start keeping a file on you. And sure enough, they did. I, through the Freedom of Information Act, a few years later, I got a copy of that Navy intelligence interview report, which only was about a page or two long, but right there, another red flag early on went up and said to me, Larry, you're on to something. If there were no importance to the subject, why are they making such a big deal of it to intimidate somebody like me, a nobody buried deep into the personnel roles of a routine military installation? So there you go. When you start asking questions on this subject, they lead to other questions more than they do.
How did his description of the meeting square with yours?
It was accurate.
Okay.
And say, you know, I've got so much literature developed from these queries in my 800 square foot. I live in the world's largest filing cabinet here, and I can barely move them around anymore because I never throw anything away that has the word UFO on it. And that's part of the legacy here that I've built up for all these many years. Somebody may one day write my own memoirs about what I've done before I get around to doing it. But when they do, they'll find it all here, ready for their taking.
You know, you talk about the secrecy sword that they use, and I think you've used the term before. When we talk about secrecy going on today, it's very similar to what it was 50 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. This field runs in cycles. You have newcomers who have great credentials and commitment and are willing to do the trench work. You have some people who enter the field for less noble reasons, maybe to feed their own ego, maybe to make a quick buck off of true believers, or maybe just to deliberately stir up trouble with fake stories.
Yeah, well, we talked about this misinformation or disinformation. That's one of the secret or one of the favorite instruments of the government, I think.
Well, it certainly is, and it's all encapsulated in a brand new book by Greg Bishop. It's called Project Beta, and it details the events that brought a physicist down in New Mexico to an early demise, a physicist named Paul Benowitz that you've probably heard about. This book, I'm reading it now, as a matter of fact. I plan to do a review of it for some newspaper or magazine interested, but I'll tell you this. The field itself is dynamic. It's troublesome on some levels. But it's the only game in town. If we're going to get to answers that we've been seeking for 50 years, we have to stay in the field to do it.
Have you ever felt your life was in danger?
No, I.
The reason I say that is because there have been mysterious deaths. I think that's one problem with the whistleblower movement. We don't really stand behind whistleblowers.
We don't, and Congress right now apparently is trying to beef up whistleblower protection legislation, and rightly so, because these are treasured members of society. These people are taking the ultimate risk of their, at least of their careers, if not their life, and they have to be treasured and protected by us, the recipients of their gift of knowledge. I collect material about whistleblowers, and I've known a few of them. I respect them. Of course, there are many reasons for doing what they do. Whatever the reason, it's in a way immaterial. The point is, they're taking the ultimate risk in their careers, and they should be protected.
Now, you mentioned earlier in our conversation the Black Projects, and maybe 300 or 400 people involved in that.
It's part of from the days of the Roswell debris recovery and back engineering and so forth. It was an understandable process that the government entered into with private industry. If you read Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, you get a flavor of the plausibility of the whole scenario and disclosure, and the disclosure was the cover-up. What a great way to mount an intelligence operation Of course, he was an intelligence officer for the Army at the Pentagon, and we need other Corso type.
Well, you were at the Pentagon. How about that? Are there other Crusaders in the Pentagon? There must be. It's a huge population.
Well, there's several thousand employees at the building itself, and there's a lot of satellite operations throughout the metropolitan Washington area, also known as the National Capital Region. All kinds of agencies that some of them we may not even know about. The National Reconnaissance Office used to be on the fourth floor of the Pentagon. I used to walk by it on a number of occasions. From my place to the cafeteria, etc., and I didn't know what was going on behind that big vaulted door. That
it was literally like a safe, huh?
Exactly, it was a huge metal door, and I knew there was something important behind that. But of course, you know, they've got their own building now, the National Reconnaissance Office, and they've opened up to the public that they actually do exist. But back in the 80s, the early 80s, and beyond. That was their existence itself was more or less classified. So, as far as I know, I was the most vocal advocate for UFO freedom of information in the building, and of course, my career it didn't necessarily profit from that high profile, but. As I say, I did manage to get retired after 36 years of honorable federal service, and I recommend retirement to anybody because it frees you up to do the important stuff in life.
Like writing this book and the other books you're talking about.
Absolutely right.
Now, are there any heroes in the Pentagon in the UFO field? Is there somebody? Is there somebody that's trying to make waves, or is it just hard to figure out exactly what's happening because it's so secret?
Well, you know, one time I was in the library. you know, this is as I say, back in the 70s, actually. I was in the library there, looking through. Their UFO book collection. Now, the library is authorized to buy commercial books from anywhere they please.
Now, you're talking about the Pentagon Library.
The Pentagon Library. It's run by the Army. It got so severely damaged in the Pentagon attack in 2001 that they had to either truncate the area or move it out of the building and to a satellite building. In any case, I was in there looking through their UFO book collection. And when you turn, this was back in the days when you would pick a card, you know, copy of the book, each copy has a little charge out card. And you could look on there and see whose names were listed on the card.
That's interesting.
And I said, holy smokes, look at these names here. And there were some, you know, majors and colonels and, you know, regular GS workers. Names basically I didn't recognize, but I said, well, this in itself is a curio to be kept.
Did you make a copy of the card?
Well, no. How about if I just say that would have been a nice thing to do?
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, there's Xerox machines there.
My employment history, which parallels my UFO research career, was on a rather sensitive footing because even when I was at Fort Eustis.
Well, I was in the Army, Fort Monroe, Fort Eustis. They were pretty interesting places.
The memoirs, I'll go into some things about, you know, the fact that my employer wasn't all that happy with my UFO interest.
Yeah.
He complained to me on occasion.
Yeah.
And so I looked at these cards and I said, well, I should track down some of these people and see how they like this book and stuff. But you know what? I've censored my own.
Don't you think that's kind of how the government, especially the military part of it, keeps secrets? I mean, you just know there's places you probably shouldn't go if you want to continue to work.
For sure. I didn't want to jeopardize my job. As a young person, I took more chances on that score than I should have, than I would have today, for example. When you're young, you're more, a little more brazen and your comeuppance. So I knew what my limits were, and I had to impose them at that time when I looked at these probably 20 or so books that had been taken out by people. Among the books were the Kehoe's books, of course, and I think the... the Condon Report, the original copy of the Condon Report, not the commercially bound version, but the sort of the free-rim binder version, was on file there amidst all that collection. So whoever chose the books from the library itself knew that this was a certainly legitimate area for Pentagon readers to sink their teeth in.
That fact alone is interesting.
That's absolutely right. So, it's been 10 years I've been back to the library since then, but since 2001, you can't get in the building anymore without an escort, even though you're a retired person, which, in the old days, once you retired, you could get back in on your own, but now you have to bother a former co-worker to escort you into the building because, the tight security now, it's a fortress at this point.
What are your feelings about that aircraft crashing into the Pentagon?
Matter of fact, Jerry, I've been asked to help Peter Gersten,
Yes, I know Peter.
Peter, the
UFO lawyer.
Exactly. Peter's the former head of Citizens Against UFO Secrecy. I being the head of the Washington, D.C. office, of course. Peter has been surfing the Internet and found that there's a possible cause to be concerned about whether a commercial aircraft really did hit the Pentagon.
Yeah, we've dealt in great detail about that.
I've just the other day, as a matter of fact, I fired off to the Naval Division a Freedom of Information request for all records pertaining to any videotape recorded of the Pentagon crash. Now, why the Navy people would have this information? Well, the answer is that several hundred yards west of the Pentagon, west of the impact area, lies a contract service station, SITGO service station, run by the Navy Exchange Service.
So there is something to that story about that tape being taken.
Let's find out. The point is, I sent this request saying, in effect, if the FBI, according to reports, did confiscate some or all of that recorded tape, then where is the tape and where are the records pertaining to that confiscation? If they actually admit it, then we've got some news to work on because, the public deserves to know, to put at rest these rumors or these speculations about what actually hit the Pentagon.
Just the idea, and I don't think a lot of, I hate to use the term conspiracy enthusiasts, but I don't think a lot of them realize that the Pentagon Library was destroyed. And that impacted by this crash, and that alone makes you wonder. And then you wonder why it hit where it did in the Pentagon. And so, there's all kinds of questions, and I'm not trying to get you off on the left field here. On
the library was a pretty big one. And in fact, their law section, interestingly enough, was where I found some information about how to file petitions for writ of habeas corpus. And I looked at a few notations, and there's not much on this, by the way, but I gathered enough to be able to draft that petition, and it did get filed and accepted by the court, so I owe it to the Pentagon Library for being a resource when I was on my lunch period, by the way, to go in there and do a little legal research and advance...
Your cause, right. You know, our time's almost up in the final minute or so here. Is there something you'd like to bring out? I mean, the book is an incredible read, and they can order it right here on the website. And in addition to that, they can go over to Galdi Press and get it. And I was struck by the fact that you've been involved with Fate Magazine for a long time, and Galdi Press now operates that magazine.
Yes, magazine. Phyllis Galdi bought out from Llewellyn Publications Fate Magazine when she was editor at one point, and now she's brought, you know, the latest issue of Fate has a great roundup on some movers and shakers in the UFO field, from MUFON people and then some independent researchers who've been asked to give their well-honed appraisals of where we stand in UFO research today. That's in the February issue, just sent to subscribers. So I recommend your listeners, to become readers of Fate if they aren't already, because Fate is going to stay. Fate dates back beyond 1952. And it's covered this subject for all those many years and expects to do the same.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with everybody there, including Phyllis Galdi and the whole crew. Larry, I enjoyed it. We could talk for hours, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Good luck on the book, and let us know when the next one comes out.
Well, one other thing. I'm involved in another First Amendment lawsuit, even as we speak, involving... complaint against the Secretary. I call him Secretary of Defense.
I like that.
And, I need to send you a press release on that, because I think you and I are kindred spirits on the public's right to know and the duties of the government to tell us.
You definitely.
You can phone me by email, and maybe you can call me again in a few months and get enough.
Well, I will, and I'll be checking with you closely, and... that's one reason I'm still an independent journalist.
Well, you keep asking, Barbara used to say when he signed off his radio show, keep asking questions, and I hope your listeners do the same. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
I've enjoyed it.
Okay, bye-bye.